Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, what's going on with our childcare and our elderly care home services?
It's not good for essentially public infrastructure. To have public infrastructure at the whims of companies that we can't even contact is extremely precarious and unsustainable. And I think that's why, you know, a strong case to be made for politicians and people of all political persuasions to be interested in the sustainability of this industry, because it needs to be fair and it needs to be sustainable because of the people involved, the people who will be affected.
We take a long, hard look at the financialisation of our services and what we can do about it. A couple of quick headlines for you. Corporate tax revenues are nearing historic lows in the United States, according to a report by the Institution on Taxation and Economic Policy. In the first year of Trump's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, 91 profitable Fortune 500 companies didn't pay a dime in federal taxes on their profits. I've got a good news story, though, for you. In Australia, Google's had to pay $481.5 million in a major victory for the Australian Tax Office. They invested in a special task force and they were strengthened by a series of laws to force tech companies to book sales made in Australia locally, instead of running them through tax havens like Singapore or Ireland. It can be done, people. We're going to talk to John Christensen now of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Right, John, so we've had a huge victory in the British general elections for the Conservative Party. In terms of donations, they totally outgunned the main opposition, the Labour Party, raising 26 times more in big money donations just in the first week. And they got great value for money, really, for all of those investing in some of the nutjob free market lobbyists posing as think tanks. Huge implications for tax justice and inequality, obviously. The Conservatives did delay their planned tax cuts for corporations and for the wealthiest just before the elections. Let's see how long that lasts. But they do know that tax cuts were a vote loser. There was a lot of voter exhaustion with Brexit after many years, which is quite hard for people to understand who don't live in Britain. When it comes to the National Health Service and how that's going to be affected by things like the UK-US trade negotiations, look out for whether the UK insists on a right to regulate in the interests of public healthcare. Also, whether the UK will insist on keeping their national bargaining rights, which US pharmaceutical companies lobbied many years ago successfully to have banned in the States. And that's one of the reasons why drug prices are so much higher there than here. But let's talk about what the election result means for the world and for Britain and for the European Union. What are the next steps for trade deal talks with the European Union? We've seen Prime Minister Boris Johnson introducing a bill that means there can be no extension after December 2020, so a year from now. He's thinking that it's all going to be tied up. What's their thinking here? Is this sort of no deal scenario, crash out scenario inevitable?
Look, in terms of priorities, securing a trade deal now with the European Union is the most important task facing the incoming government. Will the Johnson government go full steam ahead for a deal which takes Britain away from the level playing field of the single market and go full steam ahead towards Singapore on the Thames? In other words, will the Johnson government choose to stay with the European model, which is largely social democratic in terms of social and environmental protections, or will they plough on with a project of privatising, deregulating, tax cutting and turn Britain into a neoliberal hotspot sitting offshore Europe? The European Union has already flagged up its position. If Britain wants access to the single market, it will be demanding full alignment with the existing rules and regulations, and this alignment will be dynamic, meaning that as the European Union changes its rules and regulations, Britain will need to adopt those new rules and comply with them. Now, as far as the European Union is concerned, this approach is straightforward and a trade deal can be negotiated relatively fast on that basis. End 2020 is conceivable. But that type of deal is precisely what the hard Brexiteers in Britain and in Johnson's government don't want. What they want is all the benefits of free trade within the single market, but they, alongside that, they want to ditch the labour rights and the environmental protections. And as far as financial regulation is concerned, they almost certainly want to stay with a regime of light touch regulations and weak compliance. So with the election done and dusted, the Johnson government now faces the immense challenge of trying to resolve issues that until now it has refused to address in anything other than slogans. In reality, we have no idea what's on the menu for the so-called oven-ready Brexit that Prime Minister Johnson was flagging up during the election period. And it is very unlikely that the European Union will be remotely interested in any oven-ready dish which doesn't involve the stringent level playing field conditions, which they have already flagged up as their key negotiation objectives.
Yeah, and I don't know how many oven-ready meals Boris Johnson's had, but they don't taste very good. They're pretty cheap, but they're pretty poor quality. But in terms of the financial services, of course, one of the Conservative Party's big funders, they're not just one homogenous voice. Some of them want to stay in the single market because they want to retain that access. And some of them want to, you know, the kind of more extreme side of it, want to go for the Singapore on Thames, the full on tax haven model, pushing us even more into that direction. So which part of their big support base in the city are they listening to?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in terms, you know, right to describe a situation where there isn't one voice because they are divided. But let's begin with a picture of how important financial services and other business services, which includes legal and accounting services, are in terms of Britain's trade with other European member states. In 2018, Britain's exports of financial services to the European Union amounted to £26 billion, almost one-fifth of all exports in services, including travel. And on top of that, Britain exported $35 billion of other business services, as a category, other business services, which includes legal and accounting services, which are another important part of the offshore financial services provided by the City of London. So the European Union is a colossal export market for the City of London, and one which the large banks and the major law firms do not want to be locked out from. Now, I know that all sorts of pundits have been flagging up growth opportunities in Far East Asia, but with Hong Kong and Singapore already well established as offshore financial centres, and the Chinese are now talking about expanding offshore financial services through Macau, offshore China, the growth opportunities in Southeast Asia are unlikely to compensate in any way for the market share losses which will arise from a hard Brexit from Europe. So the big question will be over whether the deal that is eventually struck between Britain and the European Union will tie financial services into a dynamic alignment with the European Union. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, whether Britain goes full Singapore on the Thames and effectively locks the city out of the single market. And we really don't know. I should explain a little bit more about this dynamic alignment. What it means is that changes to the rulebook implemented after the deal is struck must be implemented by the British, which of course makes Britain a rule taker rather than a rule maker, since the UK will no longer be at the table in Brussels when decisions are being made. So effectively, staying in the single market means that Britain loses the decision-making powers that it formerly had. Now, what concerns the European Union most about the Singapore on Thames model is the fear that Britain will go full on tax competition and on regulatory competition, and will draw other European offshore financial centres into a race to the bottom, which will, at the very least, will destabilise economic and social conditions within Europe. So the chief negotiator on the European Union side, Michel Barnier, he has already made it clear that throughout the negotiations in 2020, the priority on his side, that is on the European Union side, will be guided by the overriding principle that the further the Johnson government aims to diverge from the European rulebook, the greater the restrictions that will be placed on Britain's access to the single market. Other major financial centres in Europe, including Amsterdam and Frankfurt, will be watching these negotiations very closely indeed to ensure that they do not find themselves competing on a non-level playing field against a light-touch, weak-compliance Singapore on the Thames. Now, given that Prime Minister Johnson has boxed himself into a very tight deadline for delivery of the deal by end 2020, he will need to do everything possible to avoid falling into what's called the elephant trap, which would give the European Union the upper hand in negotiations, because Johnson will be under huge pressure to make concessions in order to meet his self-imposed deadlines. And trade and services might be where concessions are most likely to be given. Now, the interesting thing about all the Brexit discussions to date has been how little public discussion there's been about the issue of trade and financial services and how that's going to be negotiated. We hear hints that the Johnson government are wanting a deal based on mutual recognition of regulatory standards, based on this notion of equivalence, which means that financial regulation standards in Britain would be treated as equivalent to those that apply within the European Union. But when I discussed this idea with some newly elected members of the European Parliament in November, they were utterly sceptical of this idea because they think the British will try very hard to degrade the regulatory standards that apply in London, and they are concerned about the long history of weak compliance by London's financial services sector. From London's perspective, there's also concern that the rules of equivalence allow the European Union to unilaterally withdraw at short notice if they think rules are not being followed. So this is potentially an unstable arrangement, and I know from recent discussions with people in the city that they consider this a fragile basis for a long-term trading relationship. So for anyone who thinks that Brexit is oven ready, think again. The really, really hard part is lying ahead of us.
Okay, and you're advocating really that the European Union now should be insisting that the UK and its satellite havens conform to transparency and regulatory compliance, and that that should be reviewed every year, because this really is going to become a rogue state.
I think there's every danger that the Singapore and the Thames model would be extremely harmful, not just to the European Union single market, but to the rest of the world. If a deal is struck which effectively puts Britain into some kind of alignment with EU regulations, I would suggest very humbly to the European Union that they should pay a lot of attention to the compliance issues, and they should look very carefully, not just at the City of London, but all the British satellites, because we know that a lot of the monkey business is parked offshore in the Channel Islands or in the Cayman or in the Isle of Man, BVI. You've got to look at Britain as a kind of a spider's web of tax havens operating together, not just focus singly on London itself.
Thanks, John. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. We've all got children in our families, or at least we all know children we care a lot about. And we've all got grandparents or parents or other elderly people we really care about too. But something ugly is happening in many countries that affects the way our most cherished people are looked after. It's a phenomenon that's raising the costs of almost every care service many of us benefit from. And until we all understand what's happening and address it, it's going to continue to hurt people. This month on the TaxCast, we look at the financialisation of public services.
The process of children being looked after by people who are invested in their future has such an impact on the rest of their lives. Those first few years form the basis for everything. Childcare really matters.
This is Liz Pemberton. She's an early years consultant and nursery manager for Edgbaston Park Day Nursery in my home city of Birmingham.
It's one of the most important sectors to work in. Historically, it's never been looked at like that. The workforce itself, predominantly female, it's notoriously underpaid, it's minimum wage, and it's not unionised. It relies heavily on investment into personal and social emotional development.
As in many countries, many parents are struggling to afford to pay for childcare, and there's something going on in the sector that's having a big effect.
The affordability of childcare is something that is spiralling out of control, and it's something that I'm very passionate about and very upset about. As a small independent day nursery, I've noticed in the past 3-4 years particularly, letters coming through from big multinational investors, corporations. Are you interested in selling the nursery? Do you want to book an appointment so we can come in and talk to you about all of the millions of pounds we could give you for your nursery? as if it's this thing that can just be sold on. These are individuals, this is our future, we're investing in these people. This is not something that can be bought. These are people's lives, this is a future that we're creating. From my experience, the corporate chain nurseries see the children as money. They are cash cows that can get them more money in the bank. The experience for the child is not the same as it would be in a, you know, more intimate, homely setting with practitioners who are well trained and personally invested in the development of that child. They're not looking at the family holistically. My message to those offshore investors, those people that are sending me these letters, sending me emails, offering me all of this money to buy the nursery, is go away. This is more than that. This is about how we're going to make sure and mobilise a whole society, a whole community, how we're going to invest in those children. 1, 2, 10!
We talk about choice in the free market, but it isn't actually a choice. Parents are stuck. They have not much choice about where they can send children, and often they don't really know where all the money they're spending is actually going.
This is Imi Carr, the co-founder of Civic Square in Birmingham, which is a network for innovative social initiatives, including hashtag radical childcare.
When you look at the increasing amount of forces, hedge funds, investment funds are buying up nurseries at a rate of knots under the guise of scale makes them work because there isn't enough government money or conditions are tight. And then you see that parents are paying more, not necessarily seeing a better quality of care, more flexibility, more choice. And then that money that is often coming in from the public purse is being extracted into tax havens and coming out of the country. And this, when I talk about this being symptomatic in childcare, this is across the park. We're seeing the same thing happening in housing. We're seeing the same thing happening in our public spaces.
We are seeing it in many sectors now, in many countries. Britain's long been the incubator for letting market forces rule so many aspects of our lives, and capitalism's always been extractive. But financialisation adds a whole new layer of possibilities. Britain's a warning to the world, really, of why it accelerates costs and ultimately contributes to worse services. Today in Britain, the private sector provides 84% of childcare for children aged 3 and under. In residential homes for elderly care, it's even higher. 94% of all beds in care homes are provided by the private sector. Here are some residents in an elderly care home in the Midlands.
I didn't like very much living alone, especially waking up in the morning to an absolute silence and nobody very near to me.
Got my own room. It's only little, but it's big enough for me. They take me for a bath or a shower, you know. I can't walk, and they get me ready for bed and put me into bed.
The staff, they're marvellous. Very, very nice, very polite and very helpful.
In Britain, about half of those in elderly care and their families are paying the bill themselves. And for those who don't have assets and can't afford it, the other half's paid for with public money. The questions we need to be asking about all this go way beyond whether making a profit from this service is a good idea. We also need to ask, what do we really know about these companies caring for our children and elderly people? How stable and sustainable are their businesses? Is this really person-focused care? The phenomenon we really need to understand and grapple with is financialisation.
1/5 of care homes are rated inadequate or needs improvement when it comes to care quality, and actually a large number are considered to be a poor standard. So people aren't getting good value for money, and they know it.
This is Vivek Kotecha of the Centre for Health and the Public Interest.
So we've been looking at, well, why is that? Why is the market so poorly provided for? Where is all the money that's going into this care home system ending up? Because it's not going to pay the workers. They're on national minimum wage and they're overworked and underpaid. So the question is, where does the money go?
Where indeed? Vivek is a chartered accountant and he's done a forensic audit of the accounts of over 830 care homes, and he's seen how the biggest for-profit providers in particular are making each elderly person's bed more expensive, to their gain and our loss. The bigger the company, the more extra we're paying, through some pretty dodgy processes that aren't adding value, at least not for us. This is all about profit extraction that's way beyond what's reasonable. And it's going on all over the world.
They've come into it seeing the fundamentals are strong. There's an aging population. There's a strong need for care home beds. Care homes are a regular, steady, reliable stream of income. And the customers or in the residents of these homes don't generally leave once they're there. They haven't got much choice. But they also have high demands on what their returns are. They have high expectations, which are beyond what's reasonable for a public service. So they've financially engineered a lot of these companies to extract, 10 to 12% return year on year, when really for a publicly provided service like that, 3 to 5% may be more reasonable. So they've set them up like that and made these businesses financially fragile. Now, they're hoping the government will buckle and give them more funding and support the existing models and just let them continue. We don't think that's good value for money. And actually, we're just going to encourage the continuation of a very extractive model, which isn't in the long-term interests of the residents or society. It's not really naturally an industry where you can make huge profit margins. But a lot of these businesses have set it up in a way that they can. The smaller operators, especially the family-run firms, often they don't make much profit in year and they're not looking for that. They're often going to sell the home as either as a business or as a property at the end of their working lives, and that money will be their kind of retirement pot. So that's a very different model from, say, some of the other businesses we found in this industry, especially the private equity-backed ones, where they're looking for more short-term cash extraction. And so the way the whole business was set up and geared was towards short-term extraction of cash and not a long-term building a business and the value up, which is then sold at the end. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we noticed just by looking at the setup and where the money went in this industry, was you can see a stark difference between different business models based on that.
Right. And there's a lot of talk about the underfunding of all sorts of public services, but this is also way beyond underfunding, mm-hmm. isn't it? It's about what are we funding? Yep. What kind of system have we set up yep. that we're funding? Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
So I think one of the biggest issues when doing this piece of a kind of forensic accounting research is transparency, or the lack of it. If an industry, which is an essential public service, is asking for more money, then I think it's fair to say we should be saying, well, where are you spending your existing money? And this isn't just a public interest issue. This is a consumer protection issue. If you look at these businesses solely on their profit, they don't seem to be making much money. I mean, the private equity ones we looked at in aggregate were making a loss. Out of every £100 they get, they're making a 10%, 9 to 10% loss. So you'd look at them and say, oh, they definitely need more money. But what looks like ordinary business costs in these companies' accounts, like rent, like interest payments out, are actually forms of hidden profit extraction. So we use the term leakage to kind of capture this concept that all the money that goes out towards profit, rent, interest payments out, directors' fees, it could be legitimate business costs, and in some cases it was, but it also can represent hidden profit extraction, so it needs to be treated with suspicion. So in terms of figures, when we looked at the kind of small to medium-sized operators in this industry, their leakage figure was about £7 out of every £100, so about 7%. When we looked at the 18 largest for-profit providers in this industry, it was £15. It was over double. So the question we then asked was, why is that? Because care homes aren't that different a business. You have to have a physical home with beds. Your majority of your cost should be on staff and then the facilities for residents. A lot of it is actual hidden profit extraction. It is not genuine business costs.
Right. And that hidden profit extraction is done in many different ways. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've seen these type of things over and over again in multinational mm-hmm. companies,
yep.
conducting transactions among themselves.
Yep.
Lending money to themselves yep. through related companies yep. at high interest rates, which are abnormally high,
yep.
use of tax havens. There are so many different yep. ways that some of these companies are giving us less value for money yep. whilst extracting, squeezing out every single last drop yep. that they can.
Yeah, there's multiple ways that they can make money out of this industry. The one that people listening to this podcast would be more aware of is the loans aspect, lending to yourself. So what we found was that about 59% of the long-term debt owed by the largest for-profits, the largest 13 for-profits, was to related companies. Now, in and of itself, that's not necessarily illegal, because if you're a big multinational, you may fund your company using loans. But the interesting point was the interest rate on some of these loans was absurdly high, given what the cost of the actual parent company's borrowing was. So we were seeing interest rates of between 7 to 16%. We saw ones where it was compounding at 30% a year with one payment after 5 years. And when you see payments like that, you realize that this isn't about a long-term investment in a business. This is about short-term extraction, or at the very least building up a kind of liability in that company where if anything goes wrong, they're the first to be paid off. A lot of these interest payments were to related companies in offshore tax havens or secrecy jurisdictions, which then further muddies how much of this is profit and how much of this is a genuine business cost. So for the five largest for-profit backed providers in this industry, the debt per bed, per care home bed, was 35 grand.
That's £35,000. Not far off $46,000 at today's exchange rate.
Which means that when you as a resident are in that bed, you are having to pay a weekly fee that supports that 35 grand of debt and its interest payments and all the payments associated with it. So in the private equity ones, £102 per bed per week was going to loan repayments, and that works out to around almost a fifth of the weekly fee that's being paid for those beds. So you're paying for a fifth of your fee at most is going towards these debts, and a lot of these debts are to themselves, so you're effectively giving them an extra boost on their profit margin. You end up with care home companies that are highly leveraged. They have huge amounts of debt on them and they don't own any assets. Now, when it comes to a malpractice lawsuit, if anything happens in those homes, those companies have very little assets. They are flimsy, wafer-thin, over-indebted companies. Now, depending on the legal jurisdiction and the application of the law and the corporate structure, that can limit their access of a lawsuit, whether it be from a public government body or from an individual and their family, to the most valuable assets of that care home group, which are its homes and any cash piles it sits on. So actually there's also an accountability issue here, which is also a severe worry about this industry. It's not being run in a way that gives you an assurance that they have a skin in the game.
In Australia, they learned the hard way the dangers of letting one corporate chain deliver too many childcare services and become too big to fail. ABC Learning grew to hold a quarter of the Australian market. But after a meteoric rise, an expansion into other countries with the aim of becoming a global childcare empire, it all collapsed spectacularly, leaving over 110,000 children and their families high and dry. It turned out it bought too many childcare centres too fast, it had huge unsustainable debts, its methods of financial reporting artificially created apparent shareholder value, and there was a mountain of transactions within the company. And 70% of its assets were intangibles, which is as dodgy as it sounds from an investment point of view. That collapse meant the government had to rescue the situation, and the resulting shortage in childcare provision pushed up prices for parents, and even more high-profile private equity funds moved in. It makes you wonder how stable as an industry that is, and where's the accountability in the end, you know, and especially if you have a complaint about an elderly person who's been treated badly. It's very, very unwise for us to be funding more of this type of thing, or encouraging more of this kind of thing, or subsidising more of this kind of thing.
And I mean, to link it to what happened with the Panama Papers and Mossack Fonseca and stuff, when you put in some of the property companies that own these care home assets onto the Panama Papers directory, they pop up. They're part of the structures, the kind of secrecy structures that exist. And that's kind of where we've ended up with care homes in this country. We've ended up in that kind of situation. And it's not accountable. It's not good for... It's essentially public infrastructure. And to have public infrastructure at the whims of companies that we can't even contact is extremely precarious and unsustainable.
We absolutely can tackle some of these problems. And if we must deploy private companies for these care services, One of the recommendations of the Centre for Health and the Public Interest report on this is a Care Home Transparency Act. Sounds like a good idea.
Care home providers should be transparent about where the income they receive goes, because the first step and the first challenge is to actually understand how they're set up in the first place. Because even with the analysis that we conducted here, we had many dead ends. We've left it to the market to do it. And unfortunately, there are parts of this industry and market who are operating very badly. They're operating in ways that, as we said, aren't sustainable, aren't accountable, and aren't in the public interest. We say that we should only allow companies to operate in this industry if they're, for the very least, they're tax registered in the UK. They should have clear corporate structures. We should be able to limit whether they're going to use secrecy jurisdictions or offshore tax havens, because it's essentially public money or consumer money going into this. We also think that there should be limits on how much debt they can load onto these companies, how easy they can hive off the assets separate from the operating company, as in they should have skin in the game and they should be able to be financially accountable.
One of the things that could be done would be new regulations in terms of what we might call reasonable profits to make out of elderly people who are vulnerable and need care.
Yeah, part of the problem with this industry is the fact that there is not enough capital going into it from people other than the biggest, often for-profit, private equity-style firms. Where's the money coming from at the moment to invest in property? It's often coming from real estate investment trusts in the US and property investment trusts. Now, they expect an inflation-adjusted return every year. So they're expecting RPI, like a form of inflation, plus 2 to 4% year-on-year growth in their rental yields, because that's what, as an investment, they need. But what that does is it then puts pressure on the people building the homes to build large homes. So 60 to 120 bed homes are the norm now in the industry. But that's not necessarily what patients want or what residents want. And actually, there's evidence that the larger the home, the worse the quality of care. So we think it's really important that not-for-profits in this sector, which is still a substantial part of it, and smaller family-run businesses, which are slowly leaving as the owners retire, we think that there should be money available, capital available at a lower cost to encourage people to build different size homes, different models, maybe more cooperative models, different, more innovative approaches, community-based ones. The other thing to note is that the biggest providers in this industry, the biggest care home groups, we think that they're so financially kind of over-leveraged now that there's nothing left for a new buyer to extract. They're pretty much at maximum extraction, as it were. They've all reached the end of their line of their kind of financial model. So without extra government funding, they're not really going anywhere. So that's the other worrying thing about it. We are locked into this too big to fail model with some of these large providers. And especially in the areas where they call them care deserts, where there's only one or two providers available.
So you foresee potentially an impending collapse?
There will be that risk, but there's also the fact that these are just some of the most vulnerable people in society. And I think that's why, you know, a strong case to be made for politicians and people of all political persuasions to be interested in the sustainability of this industry, because it needs to be fair and it needs to be sustainable because of the people involved, the people who will be affected.
Basically, government should be investing more and having more of a stake in these services.
Yeah, I agree. I think the other point about social care that we're missing is the fact that a lot of our ageing population in England is in very economically inactive areas, areas of the country, especially coastal parts of England and the UK, where young people are leaving for a lack of jobs. If we treat social care seriously and we encourage community and social investment and government investment, we can regenerate parts of the economy and parts of the country that have been left behind from decades of neoliberal growth. And what we can then do is build communities and economies where young people want to stay and people want to contribute. At the moment, that doesn't happen because a lot of the money, as we said, is leaking out of the UK. But not only that, the care workers are paid some of the lowest wages in the industry. Often it's better value for money for a care worker to work in retail stacking shelves in a supermarket than it is to be a care worker. The fact that a lot of them stay in the industry is more tantamount to the fact that they care about what they're doing. They see value in their job, even in the hardest of circumstances. This is a great opportunity to reinvigorate parts of the UK economy that are left behind. And we shouldn't miss out on that.
I've been speaking to Vivek Kotecha of the Centre for Health and the Public Interest. I highly recommend reading their report, Plugging the Leaks in the UK Care Home Industry, and you'll find that on their website www.chpi.org.uk. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.